thank you for joining us on this, you know, special second week edition thing, because we usually have one a week, but this week we have two. But there's a timeliness involved here because our friend, who I've talked to on the blog, Michael Giuliano, is running a Kickstarter for a game called Rogue System, and we want to help it. We want to get it out there. We want to get people knowing about it before it and ends in 2 weeks. So we got him on the podcast. We had a nice long chat with him, and we hope you enjoy it.
Tell us a little bit about you, Michael.
About me. Where do I start? Let's see. Before I was a game developer, which I've been for the last 14 years, I spent 8 years in the U.S. Air Force. I worked on the flight line for the B-1 bomber.
Oh, excellent.
Stationed in Dyess and then in Idaho. I joined the Air Force. I requested F-16s in Australia, and I got B-1s in Texas, which was about 7 hours from where I left. So I didn't too far.
So, but that gave you a pretty good understanding and working knowledge of aircraft switchology and such, right?
I've always been a huge aircraft fanatic, especially fighter aircraft. I just love them. Mm. I was a avionics and a flight instrument troop. I know the basics of these systems inside and out.
Oh, okay, I was an Apache crew chief myself.
There you go. So. Excellent.
Well, no, it's just the thing of, like, once you've actually been through, like, a maintenance checklist or a pre-flight on an aircraft and you actually have to sit there with the book open in your lap and it's like, which switch is it? You know? So, yeah, and I would assume in the B-1 there's a heck of a lot more going on in the cockpit systems.
It's a four-seater. You've got the two guys in front, pilot and co-pilot, and then you've got the Oso and Doso in back, offensive and defensive guys. So, yeah, there's a lot of switches up there. The Air Force was a means to an end, really. I didn't have enough for college, and I wasn't really getting anywhere if I stayed here. So, I mean, that was the best chance I had to really expand myself and not have to put in any money into it because I didn't have it. So I was in the service. It gave me a lot of technical experience, obviously. And again, being around aircraft, it fit naturally for me. And while I was in, Angel, my wife, she managed to scrounge me up a student copy of 3D Studio, and that's what I taught myself on. So when it came time for my second tour to be finished, I either had to re-enlist again or get out. She was like, well, you've got some experience. Go ahead and get out, and we'll make a go of it. And 70 resumes later, someone finally took a chance on me. My first project was Atomic Games. I worked on the Close Combat series. Which was
very cool.
Yeah, one of the first real-time strategy games, and it was all 2D and top-down at the time. So my job mainly was I painted some of the maps and did elements for the maps and did tank sprites. And you try making 64 by 64 pixels look like a tank, it was a challenge.
So did you start out like kind of mocking things up? Like really simply, you know, maybe in like a top down thing or something, trying to figure out like how you want to build this thing, or did you just jump right into 3D and it's like, let's make a cockpit model and make it fly?
No, actually the first thing I started with was the galaxy generation routine. Cause that was actually going to be one of the hardest things to accomplish. And about 6 months to a year's worth of study and research went into that. And everything is based off of, as best I could, and still make it playable and functional. And everything is based off of real world physics and elements and ideas. I use the Earth solar system or the Sol solar system, excuse me, as a basis for all my other solar systems. And again, try to extrapolate that information out.
Well, it's like it's kind of interesting whenever you look at the way the planets are situated in their orbits, that each one is I think like the square of the distance of the planet that was before it, and you know so it's kind of like once you build the algorithm, you can kind of procedurally generate the rest of the universe.
That's it exactly. And like I said, it was just taking that information that I had and extrapolating from there, so that it would apply to other solar systems that didn't exist.
Mm.
And it does a very good job of representing. It generates positions for asteroid belts and kept your belts, and there's comets, and they're on elliptical orbits, and everything orbits in real time. Everything rotates in real time, about as it would realistically. Planets can have multiple moons. Planets can have rings of their own. A lot of this stuff I still need art for, but the data itself is there and will drive the art once I have, you know, I can get an artist in there with that to help me.
Right. And I think that actually has application beyond like the flight simulator component that you want to build, because you can take that Lego brick out and use it in anything. You know, it's like, what game do we want to do a 4X strategy game? Hey, I've got this thing that'll shake and bake an entire galaxy.
Sure. Most definitely.
So tell me about, since you worked on the campaign for such a long time, I'd like to know more about it. Like, is there going to be like planet conquests that the forces do? Will you have to fight like system to system, planet to planet? Will it get that kind of granular, or will it be a little more abstract?
Eventually it will. The idea of doing a partially scripted, partially dynamic campaign, to drive the dynamic elements, you're going to have two opposing battle groups, and they'll have their own assets, and the system itself will have its own civilian assets. And all those will, from mission to mission, dictate the dynamic missions that are generated. And that is a basis, that is a foundation for being able to add multiple battle groups per side, and then having those multiple battle groups go to different systems and fighting for control. So eventually this will be a more galactic-wide conflict.
So player, is that going to be simulated where the player is not, or do you basically simulate a bubble that's around the player, and then
both.
Like the okay
both
oh, no.
What happens really is, since you know the player, this is a single player game at first, the player is the focus and should be. So where the player is, events and actions will be generated, and not just dropping in a few enemies to fight every so often. There will be all sorts of things to do and discover later on once more open ended gameplay is added. But above and beyond all that, yes, you will have these forces throughout the galaxy doing their thing without the player's involvement at all. For example, you could be just running a trade route and fly into a system, and there is a battle going on, and you never knew about it, and now you're stuck in the middle of it.
So what games are your influences? You know, all things being iterative, the Wing Commander games, the TIE Fighter stuff from back in the day, or more modern things like the X games and EVE Online and things like that. What are you looking at and kind of feeding from?
I kind of grab a little from everything. I played a lot of these games, mostly all of them, and each one has some very cool, unique little elements to it, you know, there's a lot to grasp and make use of. So yeah, just little bits here and little bits there. Like X-Wing actually had more ship management than some of the other sims, but it never really went as deep as I want to go with Rogue System. But Wing Commander certainly had the military campaign and the story behind it, and that was really great. And that's something I want to achieve in this first campaign as well, is not just the conflict, but you get to sort of know the pilots who are fighting with you. Overall, I'd say that Falcon 4 and the Sims like that, again, the way their campaigns are put together, and although they're simulating an entire war in one country, I'm, you know, my first go at this is going to be much more focused between two opposing battle groups.
Whenever the flight sims started out, you had like F-19, F-117, you know, the F-15 from MicroProse, and those games where it was kind of like you had a magic radar and the enemies just appeared on it. You know, if there was an enemy in front of you, he was a red dot on the radar kind of thing. And the space games were kind of like that as well, like Wing Commander, except it was also a magic radar, except it was just a 360-degree display. And then so much of actual modern military tactics and engagement is a detection game, because if you can't see it, you know, who sees the enemy first wins, right? So, and looking at the fidelity of like a Falcon 4 game, so the avionics got much more complicated in those games, but also the switchology of operating the game got, you know, so it's like it becomes more engaging and more fun, but you can reach to a point where the player is perhaps a little bit overwhelmed at like, well, do I have to take a college course in operating this simulator?
Right.
So I'm wondering what do you do for accessibility? Like if I have a player that doesn't really want to invest in it to a certain level, whereas you have the other guy that wants to go through the engine startup sequence and completely geek out on the thing.
That was going to be my question, which I think is hilarious.
being a science fiction environment, because although I want, you know, hardcore like system management at the deepest level, this is still a science fiction environment, and there's a lot of things you can get away with. One of them is my ship's computer. And one of the things that someone who wants a lighter experience, like what you're talking about, there will be options to give the ship's computer more and more control over some of these more deeper manual systems. At the lightest level, basically all you would have to worry about is the red blip in front of you and flying and shooting at it. At the deepest level, if you turn all these options off, then yes, you're going to have to get in and search for targets and maintain a lock and that sort of thing. And you'll have to have the switches to be able to do that.
I like how you're giving folks the option to be either crazy detailed with the switchology, as the word, as Jim used, or just push a button and go.
Well, and it's also nice that if you tell the ship's computer to do this, then the ship's computer still operates the same switches. The same thing still goes on. So it's not like there's a whole separate model that it's like you choose to play easy and you're never going to see the stuff that happens in the hard mode.
Yes, that's it exactly. And that's, as I've been talking about this, I've talked about this a couple times already in various places. And the one thing I stress is I'm not changing the simulation or how it functions. I'm just changing how much of it the player has to access.
How are you going to handle... as far as detection and electronic warfare and things like that, is that going to be a factor in
that? It will. I have a few different engagement ranges. At short range, your computer is actually your friend. It will help you. Will help you select targets at close range using their IFF signatures and everything. If you want to select an enemy target, you can put out that request and it'll search through the list of targets and help you select that. That's at close range. At medium and far ranges, then you're going to have to get involved, again, if you don't want the computer to do it for you, and you're going to have to fight background clutter, sun and other celestial bodies and elements put out, all sorts of frequencies and electromagnetics and all sorts of things that can clutter up your radar, if you will, and to try and fight through that. So, yes, there is a certain level, just like trying to, in Falcon 4, trying to fight ground clutter to pick out a target. It's the same sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have a question. One of the biggest pet peeves of mine in space games is the amount of targeting control a user has. And I still think Free Space 2 has done the best with this, allowing you to target missiles, bombs, subsystems, all that kind of stuff. While some recent games have been horrible with it.
Yes.
Terrible. And it's like, protect this thing, but you know, we're not going to tell you what to shoot at to protect it. Oh, great. So are you doing anything to help with not only targeting, but that kind of situational awareness that you need on the battlefield to keep an eye on your objective and yet keep an eye on what's going on immediately around you as well?
Well, you'll have various means to do that. For example, there'll be wingman communications, and again, your ship's computer is going to help a lot in keeping you aware of what's going on. You can't see. Yes, everything puts out its own little signature, be it a missile or a kinetic weapon or you know anything physical puts out its own signature. So if you can see it, you can target it. Now, obviously. Obviously, an enemy ship or any ship would put out a much larger signature than, say, a small missile would, so it would be easy to detect at a longer range.
See, that sounds kind of perfect, because I swear there are some times where a game wants me to kill a bunch of missiles and won't let me easily target those missiles, and I just want to rip someone's head off.
Well, you know, it's kind of an interesting environment with space, because space is really big, and there is a lot of background things there, but there's no medium for transmission. So it's like in a submarine sim, when you look at the rules that you have to play by there, there's thermal layers, there's the fluid dynamics of how sound travels in the environment and that sort of thing. So if you take that into space, with capital ships, you might end up playing a game of like a radiation version of like Hunt for Red October. There, like, where are they?
Yeah, there's three main methods of tracking. There's electromagnetic. Any piece of operating equipment puts out a field, and so when you have all your systems up and running on your ship puts out a large EM signature. There's your radiation. And also optical. Those will be your three methods of detection.
So the weapons systems that you're looking at modeling on the ship, is that going to be energy burst weapons or lasers? Or
it depends on the range. You have there's primary weapons, which are mainly short range. There are secondary weapons, which are more medium range, missiles and kinetic type weapons. And then long range would basically be more beam weapons. That have a great, great distance, and all you need is some more precise targeting to make them hit their target. But yes, at close range, you'll have plasma-based weapons. You'll have small slug thrower, repeaters and that sort of thing. And again, for medium range, you get into missiles, vector thrusted missiles, or kinetic-based weapons where your ship momentum is when you release that weapon is what the weapon flies with toward its target. So you'll have to actually aim your ship at the target and release the weapon. It's just like slinging a bomb off an F-16. The larger ships will have beam weapons because their combat range will be far, far greater than small fighters would.
So what is the role of the fighter in this? Because capital ships could accomplish it with, say, smart missiles or something. Why do you need fighters?
There's two types of defensive systems, shields and reflective armor. Shields are really meant for small fighters. It would take a tremendous amount of power to generate a shield bubble around a large capital ship, so they use reflective armor. Now, shields are great for close-range weapons, but against missile blast damage and or continuous beam weapons, they're useless. However, on a large capital ship, you have reactive armor or reflective armor, which is great against other beam weapons. It won't stop everything, but it'll reflect a lot of the damage away. And it's also armor based, so it will handle blast damage. But against those the short range energy weapons. Again, that's kind of useless because you don't have that, that shield to protect it. So the object of the fighter is to actually get in and attack those capital ships at close range, and as well as defending those capital ships. The physics for this is Newtonian based. So and there are systems available, both autopilot and one system I call it a friction induction system. To provide a more atmospheric feel, but only when you want, when you need it. Some systems are on or off. The friction induction system is actually variable. You can give it, you can adjust the feel of it. Now, for the tight combat, especially when you're flying around other ships and stuff, you want that system on because it offers you a certain level of control. Mm-hmm. But there's other times where you have to fly Newtonian style. For example, docking and taking off, you have to stay relative to the ship you're either leaving or going to and wanting to land on. And the only real way to do that is with Newtonian physics. You set your momentum to match its, and then you adjust from there to be able to get into it and land on it or in it.
So if you demand more, if you're in the non-Newtonian, the pseudo atmospheric mode, But you demand more performance from the ship than what it can actually do. Do you get sort of a pseudo Newtonian, like it lags as it tries to catch up?
Oh yes, it will. You can definitely outfly the systems with the friction induction system. It actually does generate heat on your ship's hull. If you were flying pure Newtonian and you were just racing through, racing through space, and you just instantly turn that system on, not only would you probably melt down your hull, the G forces your pilot would suffer would just kill him instantly. So there is some consideration as to when and how you use those systems.
But at least you've got the option, and you have to think about that. So
when you have games that you don't have to fly Newtonian at all, they're not really doing what they should do because everything in space is moving in some form or fashion. Ships just can't stop. Even if they're stopped relative to one another, that's one thing. But if they're stopped relative to the entire universe, well, that just doesn't make any sense.
I don't know if you ever played like the old game Tornado, where you could actually... So I'm envisioning something like that, where it's going to be multiple strike packages and time on target between the different strike packages is going to matter. And, you know, there's going to be some fidelity about actually coordinating with your fellow pilots up there. So it's not just like, oh, just go up there and wing it and pull the trigger.
No, you definitely have the right idea. It's very corny. You have to be where you're supposed to be. You have to do the job you're assigned to do, or else the entire package is going to suffer.
Man, you're saying the right buzzwords with Tornado and Falcon, I'll tell you.
Again, you know, being a huge aircraft, you know, fanatic and flight sim, hardcore flight sim fan, this is just translating that into, you know, the world of the space combat game, which I also love, is just something that I've always wanted and no one ever did. And so that's my goal here.
Aside from other small projects like Milo's Star Shatter and that along the way, the bulk of development in space game titles has been free space mods. So that's a thing where you were talking in the Kickstarter about building your game modularly and making it really mod friendly. So what's your vision for that? You know, how is the fan base going to keep legs under this thing for a decade after you release it?
Everything in Rogue System is externalized. Ships, shaders, visual effects, sound effects. Nothing is okay. Well, almost nothing. I can't say everything, but almost everything is externalized. Definitely what the player would need to, or the community would need to make it actually a completely new sim if they wanted to. You can even add your own planet classes if you wanted to, or moon classes. There's all sorts of things you can do. The way I'm creating the sim is the same way that the community would mod it. In fact, the directory structure is such to where you can have directory structures, one per mod, and eventually in the UI you'll be able to say, okay, I want to play this mod, or okay, I want to play this one, and neither one of any of them will interfere with the other one.
I have a question, because right before we started recording, you released a new video, which, of course, I have not seen, with combat and some brief AI stuff. So what can you tell us about the AI in this game, since it's primarily single player, because it's very important?
Yes. Let me start by saying that the AI have maneuvers that they draw from. Just like a fighter pilot is taught combat maneuvering and basic flight maneuvers, it's the same thing for the AI. There's offensive, defensive maneuvers, and the community can add new maneuvers. It's all scripted. The maneuvers don't actually steer the ship. What the maneuvers do is tell the pilot what he needs to do or she needs to do in order to fly that maneuver. And based on experience, some AI pilots may be better or worse at that. If they're up against a target, they'll pick one of these offensive maneuvers. They'll try it, and if it works well for them, if they happen to score a hit, they'll remember that and make use of that one again. If it doesn't work so well, they'll discard that one and go to a different one. Mm. And then if they do take some damage, then they switch to defensive maneuvers, and then they'll cycle through that list, again, learning which maneuvers work better against which targets.
And now, do the computer pilots each individually have to learn that, or is it sort of a hive mind, like the computer figures out how to beat you, and then suddenly all the enemy pilots know how what your weak spots are?
No, each AI has its own memory.
I wanted to follow up with something. You said that if they get damaged enough, they start doing defensive maneuvers. One thing I've noticed about a lot of space games is AI pilots will fight until they die, which is kind of, why would you do that? So will your AI, like if they get damaged enough, will they try and retreat, for example?
Yes they will. The AI have a range of behaviors, both physical and mental. They can panic. Your own pilot and your own ship can display these behaviors. And I think I showed this in video, one of my videos, video three, part three, I think it was. He takes some damage and he starts to breathe heavy and he just kind of freaks out for a minute because he's panicked.
Yeah, I remember the frosting on the inside of the helmet. That was really cool looking.
Yeah, that was, freezing to death is not nearly, it could happen if you sat there long enough. Heat dissipation is very, very slow. You can also, your pilot can cook to death inside his cockpit as well, if all that, which is more likely to happen if all those temperatures just get out of control.
I'm honestly glad to hear that pilots can run away.
yeah, but to finish off on that, yes, so there's a whole range of mental and physical conditions that they can suffer. And although it's just visually and displayed to the player and via audio as well, just to give you a feel for what's happening to your pilot, for the AI, it's quite different. It does affect how they perform. If they're panicked, they may try to run away, or they may try just to escape the fight, just to gather themselves up and then come back to it. So all those conditions do affect how they perform.
And this is going to go on with your AI wingman as well, right? Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I will say a lot of what I've done before, both in the Air Force and in the gaming industry, has kind of moved me in this direction in a lot of ways. That idea that you're talking about with close combat is certainly a foundation for how I treat the pilots. There's people inside these ships, and again, this is science fiction, and so there's a certain amount of, oh, that could never really happen. Well, you're probably right; it never really could happen, but In a science fiction game, sure it could. But yes, there's still people inside these ships, and they still are fighting for their life, and they should react accordingly.
Mm. Well, that's nice to hear, because even in games like Free Space 2, you can't really get attached to your pilots, because they might sound a little like, he's tearing me apart, but it's like, okay, Alpha 2, that's all I know you as, calm down. You'll be fine or you'll die, I don't care. So it's good that you're trying to make your fellow pilots a little more engaging, so you actually care about them and their morale and their performance.
That's where the whole, Wing Commander was really good at that, it's story along with the campaign. You got to talk to all these pilots, in between missions, and right. You kind of attachments to them. And that's something I do want to do. Now, funding is a different story. Character animations, it requires a character animator, and all those characters have to be modeled, and that's time and money.
How did you arrive at the $300,000 figure?
I have 14 years experience doing this. I estimated expenses, and an average mid-level experienced artist will run anywhere between $40,000 to $60,000 a year.
Okay.
We're working over the internet. I need an experienced professional to be able to sit down every day, get his work done or her work done, and do it to a certain quality level every time. We have to be efficient. So I need to know that the quality that they put out will do that. This is a 2-year development cycle. So let's say I find someone for $45,000. That's $90,000 right there. Now you have my salary for 2 years. I do have a family to support. So again, we're looking at about $45,000, maybe less, but I'm willing to do this to make this work. I'm essentially an art director without the title right now, and I get paid accordingly to manage people. I'm setting all that aside to be able to do this full time and taking the pay cut to do it.
Is there an option for, if it doesn't succeed at the goal that you have set, to perhaps reduce expectations on that and say, well, let's just fund this chunk of it? or like, let's help this thing, right. But I can't get all of it, so let's get what I can.
My next option would be, if I can't find funding elsewhere, would be a store at my website. And it would certainly, I can't make the guarantees or the promises that I'd have to make at Kickstarter. If I set a $30,000 goal and I say for that, I'm going to ship X, Y, or Z, that's what I have to do. Now, some people have said, well, why don't you just go for $50,000? Okay. And hope that you got more. Okay, great. Let's say I go for $50,000 and all I made was $50,000. Now, guess what? I can't ship what I promised. So that is in itself is a flat out lie. To go lower and hope for more is a flat out lie. I had to go for the amount I set because I know that was the minimum amount that would work for 2 years for myself, for another artist. And, there's Kickstarter fees and there's taxes. And there's also, I'd like to put the person who's been doing my sound and music on retainer. And that is $300,000 for 2 years. That's it. That's the base. Now, if I went with something at my site, I could say, okay, there would certainly be more of a donation type of thing. With I can't make any guarantees, but what I can say is when we reach this goal, this is what can happen. For example, at $50,000, I could start working for a year. Or at $100,000, myself and I could hire an artist for a year. We could work and attempt to build something and present again at Kickstarter next year for the rest. But I certainly couldn't promise for $50,000 I'll deliver a game or a sim because it just can't happen.
It's kind of been boiling this week a lot in Kickstarter and in the various forums where a lot of people came at Kickstarter with this notion that it's a pre-order system. And it's like, well, I'm giving them this and I'm guaranteed that. And it's like, well, no, it's really investing in somebody's idea and in the hope that they deliver it.
Yep.
But there's no contractual obligation that you're going to receive product, right?
There is really. Before you click on a Kickstarter, before you make your project active, Kickstarter flat out tells you that you are expected to deliver what you promise in your rewards. And typically for a game Kickstarter, you're promising to deliver, like at mine, $20. I'm promising to deliver the base sim. Roberts did it with Star Citizen. Rabin did it with Elite. So you are expected to deliver that, and there are legal repercussions if you don't. Not through Kickstarter, but certainly your backers could get together and sue you. So you have to be able to deliver what you promise, which is why you can't go, oh, I'll just ask for $50,000 and hope I get enough to make the whole thing, because if you don't, honestly, you're screwed.
Oh, well, see, that puts it in a bit of a different light.
And you've just screwed every backer who supported you. You flat out lied to them, and I refused to do it. And you know what? It happens more than people think.
Yeah, we're hearing more stories about Kickstarters who aren't delivering on their goals, aren't delivering on their promises.
Either because they flat out lied or they didn't know they were lying. You had people going in not knowing the amount of effort, not only mentally and physically, but also financially, it takes to make a game, no matter what it is.
We've seen a couple that have come back and said, we did the first Kickstarter and we succeeded, but then we found out what financial realities are, so we need a second Kickstarter to bail out the first one.
Right.
And we've seen a couple of titles that were that way. There's some notable iOS ones that I can think of. So it's best to not get into that boat for sure.
Which is why I sat down and I looked at it. I said, for myself for 2 years, for an artist for 2 years, an experienced one that I could trust to work from home, as well as the guy for my sound and practices, $300,000 is what I needed, and that's what I'm going to ask for.
Given your experience in the industry, maybe you can speak directly to this then. We've had a shift in the market where it's been like driven to pre-orders, right? Where the not so much even the publisher, but the distributors want your money up front, right? And it's like a false shortage of product, right? Let's just name GameStop. And it's like, oh, do you want this game? It's coming out in a couple of months. You better pre-order now, kind of thing. So they use that internally to drive numbers, right? And then the publishers look at that, and that, I think, is how some of the games decide whether they're going to continue to be developed or not, is did we get pre-orders or not, to what level. And I'm wondering, you know, will that come full circle to the point where game developers are told, well, you better get out there and get that Kickstarter going and show us that you have X amount of demand. If you can't raise $100,000 in Kickstarter, then venture capital doesn't want to talk to you about your development team.
That's very true, and it's happening already. I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Chris Roberts himself said, if we can reach X number of dollars through these fundraising campaigns and through community support, we have investors that will add to that. It's happening already.
So that's kind of a slippery slope, though.
It is, and it's being created. There just is not a lot of developing money. If you go, I mean, there's only a few big publishers left who have that kind of money. And, you know, to hand out to their developers, and they have trusted developers. So really all that you have left are these small independent studios such as myself. And really, crowdfunding is the only way for us to get funding to create these things.
Yeah, and occasionally you get a lottery winner like Notch, you know, where he just happened to make the right game at the right time. That was the sandbox that kind of led the charge, really. And I wonder how much Minecraft and the financial successes that it's made have influenced everything around development lately. You know, has it actually like really rocked the boat in the last 3 or 4 years?
Well, I think so, because I've seen more and more developers adopt that kind of pay for alpha model that Minecraft adopted, where you paid 13 or 15 bucks and you got the alpha. Mm. And you could help mold that into the final game, or you could just play around with it, but you got in early. And yeah.
A lot but he wasn't beholden to investors, though, at that
no,
point.
No.
So
he still isn't.
That changes
is he?
The game.
I don't think he still is.
I don't think so. Yeah, I think they're their own thing.
Yeah. So that would you consider that an option? Like, do pre-orders on your site and allow people to play the game as early as wherever it is, and then maybe have word of mouth spread about it, Mike? Would that be a possibility?
That's exactly what I mean by starting a store at my site. Sort of thing.
Okay.
I would have very similar rewards as to what's over at Kickstarter. But yeah. Again, it would be impossible at that point without, unless I reached a certain level of funding, until that point, could I say I can deliver X or Y or Z on such and such a date. Until I reach that level, this is what I want to deliver. And if I have enough funding, I'll be able to do that. But until I reach that level of funding, there's no guarantees I can make you. I have every intention, even if it takes the rest of my life to finish this thing, I will. But I can't tell someone, okay, if you invest $100, it may take the rest of my life, but eventually you'll get your sim. Well, okay, that's asking a little too much. You know what I'm saying?
I'm not sure it is. To be honest, if you had a product that looked intriguing enough, and even if it wasn't finished, I'd still want to try it, and I would pay 30 bucks to do it. Because I'm a compulsive spender, but also,
well, you can get your beta testing team and your quality assurance to pay you to work.
What it would be like. You know, you would expect that the people who are, you know, really into what you were doing would be the first to get involved with something like that. And you could also expect them to be really heavy into the alpha and beta testing. So that's basically what they would be buying into. You're absolutely, absolutely right.
So what about the mod community? Have you gone after those guys? Because like the people that just put out the Wing Commander mod game after like 10 years of development, I know they don't have anything to do right now. So maybe they'll come work for free. They worked 10 years on that thing for free. It's beautiful, by the way.
And again, I have, since the Kickstarter has been running, I've gotten several inquiries about, you know, even if you can't pay me, I would like to help out. And I definitely will be taking a look at that, especially if the Kickstarter is not successful. Obviously, I would always like to compensate people for the work they do. It's just the right way to do things. But if I can't, if I don't have the funds, obviously I can't pay anybody to do anything. So I would love the voluntary help. I'm keeping a running list of those people that have made those inquiries.
Okay.
Oh, good.
So So if I were a developer and I was itching to jump out and make my own thing and try this, what wisdom would you lay on me?
The first one is make sure you have a really good idea. Obviously, you know, you try to do something different, which is exactly what I try to do with Rogue System. Yes, it is a space combat sim, but I believe it's a very unique take on it. And even then, you're not guaranteed to really break through. The second would be, if you intend to go to Kickstarter, don't even remotely think that it's something that you can just throw up there and not do anything with. I said in another interview, this is like a full-time job. I have to work this thing every minute of every day, and I already have a full-time job, so it's really, really hard to do that. But you have to stay on top of it from the time you hit go until it ends to make it work. And as much as I'm doing, I don't have a team of artists and web designers behind me that I can pay to help me with this thing. It is just me, myself, and I trying to manage this. And it's really, really, really hard.
Yeah. I don't envy you, man. And every day I visit these Kickstarters, and yours included. And I've seen some that like languish for a while, and then the 11th hour, they just, you know, people are like, they get that email from the remind me thing. It's like, oh yeah. And then bam. So there's still that possibility.
Like I said, the Kickstarter, you mentioned the name and I forget off the top of my head, but you know, almost 1 million in one day. It is more than possible to achieve this in the last hour, I put out updates just about every day. You know, I know this is really hard. It's really hard on me too. Thank you so much for your support. Keep trying to get the word out. It could still pan out in the end. Until that clock says zero, I am not giving up on this damn thing.
Nor should you. There was a space sim where that happened. Starlight Inception was one where it languished for quite a long time. In the last 24 to 36 hours, it made up – I don't remember if its goal was as high as yours, but it made up 50 to 60% of its campaign, if I recall, in the last 36 hours.
Okay, so what's the best thing that people who want to support you can do for this is get more eyes on your Kickstarter?
If I had my wish, everyone who said that, you know, I've already, you know, pledged to Star Citizen or Elite and you know, that's where my loyalties lie and that's where my money is. If I could just get those people or the ones that say, you know, this looks really interesting and it's amazing what he's done on his own. But again, you know, I'm waiting on Star Citizen or Elite or whatever. If I could just get those people to come, you know, take a look at it and forget that my name is not Roberts and is not Brabham and just take a look at it and judge it on its own merits, I know that they would find a lot of unique aspects in Rogue System, just as there are going to be unique aspects in Star Citizen and Elite and what's the other one? Limit Theory, I believe it is.
Yeah.
Well, I think also that it's a matter of impact as well. Like if people want to think that what I'm doing with my $50 or $20, I could give it to Roberts and that's a drop in his bucket. Or I could put it on Rogue System where it's actually going to have a very measurable effect.
Right.
That is very true.
So it's kind of a thing of like, gosh, if you'd been a year earlier, then you wouldn't have that elephant in the room.
If I had been 5 months earlier, and those 5 months, there was 6 months about a year ago to where my job with Image Space had me working about 18 hours a day. I had absolutely no more time to give to Rogue Systems. I had to put it aside for 6 months. Had I not had to do that, I probably could have beat everyone to the, you know, to the starting gate. But that's all water under the bridge.
Right.
I think the situation I have now, and I just trying to make this work.
So what's the length of your dev cycle? About 2 years, you're thinking, before you'd be able to ship product? Or
at the minimum team size, yes. I would need 2 years to get the core module in its base incarnation ready to go. If, you know, we reached a stretch goal or two and I could add more people to the team, there's more I could do in that time, or I could take what I want to do and shorten that dev cycle, you know, however we want to go about that.
At what point do I actually get access to some kind of code? Like, can I diddle around in the ship and see what you've got? Or is that going to be a burden to you that, oh, well, I have to keep knocking out these demo builds for the fans that, you know, I have an obligation to do that, but it takes away from dev time. Because it's not like everybody's going to have Visual Studio at home and you can just, like, drop source on them.
No, I understand what you're saying. The base goal that you can start getting your hands on code is $20, and you will get the core module, which is the base simulation, when it's released in 2 years after all testing. If you want to get involved in testing, there's upgrades for that $20 reward tier to get you early beta and alpha access. Or there's also other reward tiers separately, like the $100 tier gives you access to not only the core module when it's released, all extension modules when they're eventually released. You also get full alpha and beta testing for the core module. So for $100, you would basically get anything that will ever be released for Rogue System, because I'm planning a lot. And if I can just get this core element out there, I know the rest will come.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also, you get the soundtrack CD digital, and there's a couple, there's a novella digital, and there's also a coffee table book digital that you would get with that as well.
Oh, cool. Hey, speaking of soundtracks, our show last night, actually, we talked about game soundtracks and played, you know, some individual songs from like Wing Commander, from Homeworld, some of that iMuse stuff from TIE Fighter. And there's some really epic, like, orchestral sweeping, just giant scores that are out there for that. What's the plan for the soundtrack for this thing? Are you going to procedurally generate the music as well?
Well, again, part of the $300,000 is to keep my current sound and music artist on retainer. And we have this plan for in the in-sim music to kind of change and morph using layers as the action changes.
Oh, good. So it's going to
be Brian's dancing.
Yeah, no, I love interactive dynamic music. I think that's something of a lost art. So I'm really happy to hear that.
I actually have some code in place for the basis of that already. It's just waiting to see what happens as to, you know, when and if we can get started full time on this thing, and he can get work full time on this thing.
Right.
So do you have sort of like a Rogue System, like a Bible that you're compiling? Like, this is the systems, this is how they work, and this is how I want them to interact in the game, and that. Are you kind of like laying this this thing out ahead of time, or are you just going to see what's fun?
I have dozens of design documents. I'm treating Rogue System as any other professionally developed product or a game product. I have design documents. I have personal milestone documents, which is how I've managed to progress and do as much as I've done in the limited time, you know, the part time I've had, is following these milestones, scheduling them out and making sure I meet goals. I have documents, and actually on the Kickstarter page, there's a core systems list that I kind of compiled from one of those documents stating the core systems. It doesn't go as in depth as my documents do, but it gives you the general connection between each system. But yes, I have a lot of information.
And again, that's something I think you did right with your Kickstarter, because it's just full of information, and it fully explains why you need the money you say you did. If you just scroll down a bit, it fully explains everything. So,
and, you know,
again,
I've had a lot of comments saying I provide too much information.
Well, since you didn't have to conduct a pitch meeting with anybody but yourself, how do you work about organizing this? Like, you have this dream and some ideas, right? So how do those design documents actually come together? Like, what is the first thing that you do?
Well, in my case, you know, when I wanted to do this, those 2 years I was taking myself to teach C++, I was also thinking inside my head about the general gameplay and the systems involved and how I wanted everything to interact and how I could start simply and grow that over time by adding different modules. And the design documents just come from basically notes that you jot down about this stuff. And eventually you take all those notes and you look at each one and you try and detail it a bit more and formulate it. And then you can start to list those in a proper design document and break it all up into, okay, what's needed for this, what's needed for this, and then you can even start to schedule that out.
Okay, and since you've got a lot of development experience, you can kind of look at that and see what is actually realistic and what might be a little bit overambitious to getting in the first release, so
right,
that kind of thing.
Which is exactly where the core module and the extension modules come from. Were I to claim that I could do everything I wanted within 2 years with a very small team, again, I'd be flat out lying, and I'm not going to do that. I have very realistic goals that I've planned out that I know I can meet.
I just wish you luck, man. I really want to see this succeed one way or another. I'm very excited about this game, just to be every facet of it.
I thank you for that. And again, like I said, success or not with the Kickstarter, you know, if it doesn't make the goal, it doesn't mean that Rogue System is dead. I've just invested way too much of myself into this, and so is my family. It would be a slap in their face. For almost 4 years, they've been giving me all the time I need to do everything I've done to this point. For me just to give up now because, you know, the Kickstarter didn't make a goal, that would be, you know, thanks for all that time. You know, it was 4 years, and it really didn't, you know, it didn't make a whole hell of a lot of difference. So, no thanks. You know what I'm saying? I just can't disrespect them like that. I've got to finish this no matter what. But my main goal is to make my sim. And like I said, if once that's done and that's all there is, then that's all there is. But at least I set out and I accomplished what I set out to do, if it makes sense.
Okay. Awesome. All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you guys very much. I really do appreciate it.
All right. And thanks for your time.
Thank you so much. We appreciate it.